This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This GHIL podcast episode is a lecture by Philip Rössner, Professor of Early Modern History at the University of Manchester, on peasants, wars and evil coins, towards a monetary turn in explaining the Revolution of 1525. The Great German Peasant War of 1524-26 has quietly slipped off the historian's agenda. Structural materialist interpretations have waned since the fall of the Iron Curtain, giving rise to several cultural and other turns, most of which have also passed. One phenomenon, however, has been missed completely in older as well as more recent historiography: the monetary problem. Monetary issues relating to currency and how different coins were used to pay fines, dues, and tithes featured in most known medieval peasant grievances after the Peasant War proper, significantly contributing to the peasants' economic cause for revolt. Rössner's lecture suggests how a monetary turn may shed new light on Germany's first modern revolution.
Thank you very much, Christina. I'm delighted, obviously, to be here and very pleased about the invitation. This is stuff that I've been first thinking about in relation to that public distinction. So it's literally old stuff. Does money stink? Around 1500, many people would certainly have endorsed that claim, at least regarding particular types of coin. In 1514, the peasants of Elchesheim and Steinmauern in the Margraviate of Baden complained bitterly amongst many things, and peasants obviously complained habitually. One of their specific grievances was about the way they paid tax. I quote, "Whenever the poor common man is asked to pay their tax, the administrators, even in those cases where the sums fall due below the value of one gulden, insist on payment in gold, i.e. at an enhanced exchange rate containing an agio on payments in currency other than actual gold florins. Nay, your officials refuse accepting the common land currency issued by our gracious lord, the Margrave himself, meaning we're forced to take considerable trouble and toils going about and around trying to get good money, which gold, which causes us a lot of mishaps and loss. But since, our dear lord, we poor people don't usually come across much gold or gold coin, and our dear lord's Landesordnung, which is the territorial ordinance, forbids us to engage in coin trading and the purchase of gold at any more than the legal rate anyway, we humbly petition your princely lordship that you may accept tax and other such payments in your lordship's own common land currency or currency of similar value and type." End of quote. This passage highlights in a nutshell the monetary problem of the medieval peasant wars. This came from the Poor Konrad movement, a series of local uprisings in the south haunting Baden and Württemberg, in particular around 1514. Monetary complaints similar in nature to the one above were known from practically all medieval popular uprisings in the German-speaking lands from the late 1450s to the Great German Peasant War or Revolution of 1525. And they, to a sense, continued beyond. In fact, medieval peasant risings were manifestly co-determined by money and matters of currency, especially shortages of some coins, and the way that payments and obligations were to be settled between individuals interacting in the marketplace and in the realm of taxation. Thus, I want to bring in a monetary turn as a new or sort of alternative lens on the Great German Peasant War of 1524-25, including its predecessors. Monetary factors have quite simply been overlooked by scholarship in the past, even though some would see their significance earlier on. In the history of the Peasant War, Friedrich Engels noted in 1850 how coin matters were one of the prime economic problems of the early Reformation. In Engels's model, currency debasement was part and parcel of the larger economic burdens imposed upon the common man in the age of political economic changes towards early capitalism, marked by a ruthless drive of the feudal nobility for revenue optimization, and the emerging princely fiscal military states with their incessant hunger for money. In later narratives, the coin question got all but forgotten. But in the commercially and economically developed areas in central and southwest Germany, where the peasant war was particularly rampant, coins were common objects of daily use in cities and towns, and their hinterlands, especially in areas with a high level of manufacturing. The amount of money in circulation and its velocity were also quite high. Given the ubiquity of coins in the medieval and early modern economy, their absence from historians' narratives both on the Peasants' War as well as more generally seems striking, especially so since many specific local and regional complaints from the time mention money, including Articles 2, 8, 9 and 11 of the 12 Articles of the Upper Swabian Peasantry, which became adopted as a somewhat national programmatic during the war. These specifically related to payments, but which automatically triggers the question, or should trigger, in payment in what money exactly? If there was indeed some one uniting feature applying to most known uprisings of the late medieval era, equally fitting both Western models such as Blickler's Revolution 1525, as well as Eastern ones such as the early bourgeois revolution, which was the standard narrative amongst Marxist scholars, affecting broader social groups and actors across a number of politically inhomogeneous areas and regions within the empire, money was it. Let me just give some examples. The so-called Plappert War in August-September 1458, which saw 4,000 Confederates march against the city of Constance, had allegedly been caused by local conflicts about coin. Constance citizens were accused of having refused Swiss coins in payment, derogatorily referring to them as cow coins, Kuhplapparte in the original document. Indeed, such Plapparte were a quite unstable type of coin right at the time, same time the Salzburg Peasant War occurred after a massive inflation 1458 to 1460, caused by an excessive minting of heavily debased small coins that consisted practically entirely of copper. Called Schinderlinge, the contemporary a language or literally oppressor's penny, these coins were practically useless. Minted in the Austrian lands since the mid-1450s, they were labeled bad or böse in the original, which can be easily translated as evil or bad or to be written off, so to speak. These spread across the Alps, wreaking widespread economic havoc. Initially, as per their official valuation, 4,300 pennies would have been struck from the Austrian silver mark by May 1459. But by spring 1460, about a year later, this had increased more than fivefold to more than 23,000 pennies. What had been a weak currency in the first place became a doomed currency in the end. The Schinderlinge, or oppressor's pennies, triggered the first documented European hyperinflation. Coins rapidly flowed to Vienna, Styria, Carniola, and southern Germany. Complaints centered around the upcharge or agio that people had to pay on payments when made on such bad pennies, preferring older, better, or heavier coins instead. People heavily discounted or refused to accept these pennies and payments. In 1460, the regional diet of Gollersdorf summarized the effects of that inflation as follows. No war, no plunder or armed robbery, no arson could possibly have ruined the country the way the Schinderling has. Even though, as an event, the Schinderling hyperinflation was quite exceptional, complaints about bad coin, however, were not. They were quite regular in the Middle Ages, nor were they limited to Austria or the Alps. In 1504, the farmers of Thurgau in the Swiss Confederacy lamented about the Rollenbatzen, a notoriously bad or again evil type of small change coin whose value was heavily contested only by the imperial currency edict of 1559. They were finally prohibited. When peasants sold their wine and other products on the market, they were paid in coins that were heavily discounted when used in other follow-up transactions such as purchases of corn, oats, and so forth. Farmers lost on the exchange, even if their sales may have fetched the nominal asking price in the first place. Farmers pleaded to their authorities to produce sound currency, accepted equally in peasant purchases as well as sales, i.e. given and taken at exactly the same ratio in all day-to-day transactions. Now, that money did not, the monies of the time, or many monies of the time, did not fulfill what is nowadays considered the basic precondition or purpose of money, to serve as a reliable means of exchange, a means of payment equally accepted by everybody, a means of storing value, a means of denoting prices, the key economic functions of money. This may sound bewildering. It runs against the modern monetary imagination. Moreover, it also contradicts historians' textbook narratives that usually assume an assumption not normally made explicit, that a florin was a gulden, a thaler, thaler, or a groschen, worth so many batzen, schilling, and so forth, and that we can write the monetary history of the German-speaking land simply by looking at currency, contemporary currency ordinance, monetary edicts, and the related documentation without actually questioning the sources that whether was what was stipulated in such ordinance were really the case, the reality. Why would one question that anyway, given the way how money works nowadays? But back to our Thurgau peasants, their Rollenbatzen coin that they complained about were widely considered to be a complete nuisance, as the 1504 complaint suggests. They were valued between 11 or 12 pennies, depending on whether the farmer was required to pay or got paid in such coins. Either way, this market valuation fell far short of the official rate, which had been fixed at 16 pennies to the batzen. Finally, Franconian and Swabian mintmasters, government officials tasked with determining official coin values and bringing order into the monetary landscape, capitulated. It was impossible, or so they declared, to put a reliable tariff on these coins. On the left-hand side, you see an example of that particular type. On the right-hand side, the Schinderling. Think of it, of the Schinderling of about 1 to 2 centimeters in diameter. A really bad coin, and you immediately see, even its material qualities, people would immediately have appreciated the badness of that type of coin. Similar scenarios ensued elsewhere. In 1511, for instance, peasants of Kammer and Kobel in Austria complained that whilst they had by statute to pay taxes in good coin, they did not normally come by such money. But when using their own pennies, hellers, and such like small change coins instead, which contained little and often no silver at all, authorities refused to accept them at face value, asking for more than was said in the official edicts. Similar peasants of Elchesheim and Steinmauern in the Margraviate of Baden, which we saw in the beginning, or the peasants from Wotenfels, Gagnau, Bischwein in the same area. In the same regions, complaints had been heard since the 1470s about by the raftsmen on the Upper Rhine, which had a regular droving trade, a timber trade downriver, who were paid for their services at the official rate of 24 white pennies to the florin, as official stipulated by the Margraves of Baden and the Dukes of Württemberg, but were never asked to pay tax to the territorial authorities. The Ries and other administrators frequently refused to accept these pennies at face value at the official rates. They discounted them up to 3 or 4 pennies, driving up the spot exchange rate of the full-bodied florin or gulden to 27 rather than 24 white pennies. To the authorities, these extra pennies would have represented a risk premium in modern terms, a rational economic move in principle. The peasants, however, considered it to be a violation of the common good, and they said so specifically in many complaints. Currency and coin matters gave rise to perennial bargaining, heckling, conflict, and complaints. Here a few further words of context may perhaps be in order. The prevailing monetary standard was based on a tacit understanding. It was never quite written down, but assumed that small and medium-sized coins ought to contain about as much silver as indicated by their nominal purchasing power based on what they were supposed to be buying on markets, if handed over uncoined in the shape of raw silver bars or ingots. From this, only a small amount was deducted for what's called brassage and seigniorage, that's the duties that the rulers charge in return for producing money. And the brassage is something that goes to the mintmaster in order for recovering for the cost of producing coins. It was furthermore understood that small change coins like pennies, hellers, kreuzer, and medium change coins such as groschen or batzen contain proportionally less precious metal than high-value coins such as thalers, silver thalers, and florins. This was to recover for the cost of minting, otherwise they would have been minted at a loss, which would likely have resulted in small change supply drying up altogether, because it wouldn't have been possible to produce for the mints. But the common man, obviously, and his wife needed small change coins for their daily economy, and they had no use for full-bodied coins, very little use for it, in the quotidian peasant market economy. Think about thalers around 1500. You'd use them for 50 or 100 thalers. You could get a medium-sized, well-equipped farmstead. I mean, a thaler, a florin was not the type of money that the common peasant habitually used. Now, it was a feature of the monetary landscape then that even though exchange rates between small, medium, and high-value coins were fixed, usually by law, whenever small change coins were too old, unknown, or too many foreign nominals around, the market would change these rates. Administrators charged with collecting tax, rents, and fines often refused to accept them at face value. Farmers were directly harmed by this, as such bad coin literally ate into their meager pockets. These incidents were not limited to Switzerland, Swabia, or Southwest Germany or the Tyrol, but by the 1520s, immediately before the war, they had become omnipresent, ubiquitous, and even moved onto the imperial agenda. In 1522, upon the Nuremberg Diets, imperial cities lamented that both the German nation, I quote, as well as the common man, are burdened with the sheer variety and ubiquity of bad silver and small change coin. End of quote. They complained that the good, reliable money was exported out of the German-speaking lands, which benefited mainly mint masters, merchants, money traders, cunning financiers, but considerably harmed the common weal. These complaints echoed the Reformatio Sigismundi from around about 1439, a programmatic discussing imperial reform, including, amongst many things, various matters of political economy, usury, and other market manipulations. Also featuring comments on how currency debasement betrayed, as these sources say, the interests of the common man. Nearly the same terminology was employed in the likewise anonymous Upper Rhenish revolutionary, the Oberrheinische Revolutionär, a document produced around 1500, which noted how the common man, again, was disadvantaged by the coin. People lend in bad money and demand payment in good money in return, said Sebastian Brandt in his Foolship as early as 1494. The Imperial Diets of 1525 picked up the problematic Batzen coins, which we've discussed before. These were held responsible for many evils and mishaps of the common man. Based on an anonymous pamphlet from 1523 entitled The German Nation and Its Problems, Ordering and Reforming the Estates and the Empire, Friedrich Weigand's draft imperial constitution of 1525 proposed a common imperial currency to solve the issues with unstable money. The empire should have no more than 20 or 21 mints, i.e. places where coins were made and struck, so that the common man remained unscathed, as the document says. Michael Geismayr's Tyrolean Constitution of 1526, which is another one of the great utopias of the age of the peasant war. And they were not always utopias. I mean, often they were quite practical and hands-on and picked up problems that were real. Called for a return to, I quote, good sound currency as we used to have under Emperor Sigismund, end of quote. As Oliver Folkert has noted, negotiations about a common currency took place not only at practically all imperial diets between the 1520s and the 1550s. Currency remained one of the pressing political economy discourses before, during, and beyond the Reformation. Medieval scholastics like Gabriel Biel, a very influential theologian of the 15th century, who had written a widely read treatise on money, which was continued to in print, and widely read after the 1520s, were well aware of the dangers of coin usury, which they defined as unfair gains in the marketplace, accruing to tricksters who knew how to handle differential types of coin so as to kill a profit from the deal. Luther cried out in his Catechism of 1529, quote, what a plague the world is now suffering from the bad and evil coin, which on a daily basis harms common trade, commerce, and labor. End of quote. His 1520 sermon on usury, a work that made it into his bigger economic treatise on commerce and usury, 1524, insisted that, quote, no one would normally borrow rye for wheat or bad coin for good coin, end of quote, meaning repayment would be asked in the better type of the good, since this meant asking for more than had been initially given, another flat-out definition of usury. In a more personal context, a letter dated 1540, a few years before his death, Martin Luther wrote to his wife, Katerina, that, quote, "We have here not a single penny and hardly any small change, possibly as little as you have at Wittenberg, and that people should refrain from using Märkische Groschen and the Schottenheller, as these considerably our lands and their people being worth less than 5 LS each," end of quote. From the numismatic record, it's unclear what coins exactly the Schottenheller, which literally translates as a Scots heller, were. But we can be quite sure they represented bad money, as by the 16th century, the term Schotten, Scots, by no means necessarily or exclusively referring to Scottish people, could also refer to Northern English or Irish people, Scotus, the Latin term, but enjoyed white currency denoting shoddiness. It had attained a proverbially pejorative connotation in the German-speaking lands. Luther obviously referred to the base foreign coins of dubious value. They were identified as harmful to the people. But note that Luther also mentions a general shortage of small change. And if we read the letter carefully, it is not small change as such that is in short supply, but good small change, reliable small change coins. Luther thus reiterated a problem raised since the later 15th century, a problem that would continue in early modern German political economy, Kameralwissenschaften, for instance, Cameralism, right to the end of the 18th century. Germans were perennially short of reliable money. In 1519, the newly crowned emperor, Charles V, committed to creating a stable, unified imperial currency because, I quote, "our empire has suffered many woes from bad coin," end of quote. The issue became, as we've seen, a major item in the Nuremberg Diet. 1522-24, imperial currency matters were negotiated between November 1522 and January 1523, and again, December 1523 to April 24. Imperial states now took matters of currency seriously, realizing how they contributed widely to political instability and social unrest. The first imperial currency ordinance of Esslingen was ratified in fall 1524, but many scholars argue that it came to naught, remaining utopian because of the unrealistic pricing of coins and mint ratios. Meanwhile, the peasant war had begun. When the miners of Upper Hungary in Neusol, Chemnitz, and Kremnitz, important silver mining and metalworking districts, and I'm not going to go to pronounce the Slovak names in modern days, but they're all located in modern day Slovakia, revolted in 1524, they explicitly referred to the currency debasement of 1521 as the main cause of their woes, costing them on average about 50% of their local money's purchasing power. In Tyrol, the Articles of the Brixen Peasant in May 1525 called for a, quote, "return to the old currency standard that the world has seen under Emperor Sigismund and as a means of protecting the people," end of quote. The 32nd Article of the Meran and Innsbruck Peasants in 1525 specifically marked out the agio, so the charge that was charged on the use of small change, or Aufwechsel, as it was called in the original document, as a cause for concern, asking again, quote, "for a good currency to be struck." In southwest Germany, where complaints about coin had been frequent, especially during the poor Konrad movement, very similar grievances came on the agenda in 1525 again. Peasants of the bishopric Würzburg of Eltmann, for instance, put coin matters at the second article of their complaint because they were disadvantaged by the new currency, as is in the adjacent Münnerstadt, nearby Kissingen in Bavaria, which is Bavaria today, same bishopric, noted that good old hard money was difficult to come by. The prevailing local small change coins consisted of a confusing variety of debased nominals of dubious provenience, property, and age. Meanwhile, authorities insisted on the payment of duties and fines in high quality money. Burghers of Würzburg, the Würzburg citizens, capital city of the said prince bishopric, or Hochstift, confirmed that the poor suffered the most from bad currency. They had to pay their dues, their rent, and other fines in new coin, but according to values fixed using old currency relations, which eroded peasants' purchasing power by about a third. Farmers in the adjacent local districts and Emter in the same bishopric had similar grievances. Here, the taxman asked for up to 63 rather than the customary legal 60 Kreuzer per gulden or florin when collecting dues. Similar in many, many other locations, Upper Swabia or elsewhere. In the Alpine regions, however, important mining districts linked to the international economy and commercial capitalism, providing up to a third of European silver supply at the time. Grievances about coin mirrored 1525, those heard in the same locations since the 1460s. The 12th article of the grievances of the Salzburg peasants likewise identified the agio, the charge on the use of small change coins, as usurious. In other areas of Tyrol, in Kitzbühel, for instance, peasants put that problem on top of their agenda and literally start their complaint with, quote, "First of all, we're complaining about the agio, about the Aufwechsler," which has been increased for as long as we can remember. So the charge that they were asked to pay when using small change rather than good money. In the district of Anras and Heinfels, same locations, laments were heard about the feudal lords having recently raised fees and other dues whilst demanding payment according to the new ratio rather than the old exchange rate. Peasants further west, near Strasbourg, asked for the land currency to be equally accepted as high-value money in the payment of tax fees and fines. Counties in central Germany, in Mansfeld and Thuringia, miners and smelters habitually protested about payment in bad and evil coin again. And again, in these areas, we've heard these complaints, or complaints were heard since the 1460s, as they were in the Saxon tin and silver mining districts. The miners of Joachimsthal, Jachimov, in modern-day Czech Republic, another main supplier of silver, from which later on the silver thaler or dollar received its name, singled out in an exceptionally clear way in 1525 the political economic connections between silver mining, proto-global payments and trade, a prevailing lack of silver in situ and accordingly weak local currencies. The third article pinpointed silver exports, and merchants who were responsible for these exports, as a prime cause for the prevailing weak currency and the ensuing social problems. Paid in bad local small change, miners' money bought much less proportionally in day-to-day trade than the much coveted but hard-to-obtain high-value silver thalers that sprang from that area. In central Germany, similar to the Würzburg peasants and the mining peasants complained about again, tax they had to be paid in gold or good coin, and if they didn't come by gold, they were forced to pay more than the official rate. Let's just stop. I mean, it could go on and on endlessly with this list because they're really quite extensive in terms of the number of the known complaints. This was a ubiquitous and habitual problem. Let's just pause for a moment and consider some of the political economy implications of that. Since the 14th century, European peasants showed remarkable proclivity to revolt. Organized peasant arrests can be documented as late as the 1920s, for instance, in the Schleswig-Landsvolk rebellions, the Black Flag movement, imitating some of the 1525 peasant war symbolism with a sort of flag and some of the symbols which were directly adapted from the 1525 revolution. Peasant revolts need not be particularly warlike or violent either. Recent scholarship has mapped out the 1525 revolution as relatively unbloody from the peasant side. Peasants' wrath seems to have been focused more on symbolic destruction of castles and other capital assets, whilst the main brunt of violence and atrocity came from the side of those who subdued the revolt, the Swabian League and its Confederation Army, led by Georg von Waldburg-Zeil, the peasant George of Bauernjörg, brutally crushing the revolt. Even the mercenaries of the League were commonly paid on the very same bad, debased small and medium change coins, which the peasants they fought so bitterly lamented against. Monetary grievances continued after the war. As late as 1549, Saxon delegates to the Imperial Monetary Conference in Speyer warned, presumably with distant memory of the Great War, that a lack of reliable small change would, I quote, "burden the common man and likely lead to a national revolt again." End of quote. And I'm indebted to Oliver Volkert for supplying that quote to me. But between the 1460s and the 1520s, the situation was somewhat different. Increasing rates of monetary debasement coincided with increasing incidents of popular revolt. After 1500, they gained further traction as imperial discourses intensified, calling for a unified imperial currency. Merging with the Causa Luteri, religious, monetary, and political reform became entangled, the religious schism threatening the integrity of the empire's fabric in the same way as monetary fragmentation and bad currency, or unjust business practices by some of the largest firms of their age, the Nuremberg and Augsburg Big Fish, which were highlighted, such as the Fugger, the Belzer, the Höchstädter companies, which featured large on the Nuremberg and Augsburg diets and the monopoly debates of the 1520s. During the early 1500s and into the 1520s, silver outflows from the German-speaking lands intensified, whilst Nuremberg and Augsburg Big Fish increased their financial engagement in places like Venice, Lisbon, and Antwerp, the biggest trading hubs in international finance and trade. The silver outflow, controlled by the big German trading firms or last medieval super companies, to use Edwin Hunt's classification, financed Portuguese overseas expansion and the emerging interoceanic trades, whilst leaving relatively little monetary material in the Holy Roman Empire itself. At the same time, when minting output boomed, central and southern German mints literally dried up, causing deflation because money was in short supply, and debasement because money supply had to be stretched to extremes to supply a growing population with cash. A vicious trade-off unfolded for rulers between producing no good currency and no currency altogether. Either would have increased economic instability. There are more than 300 authorities and princes in the empire, including electors, dukes, counts, bishops, and prince bishops, down to the free imperial cities, and many more who exercised the regalian right to mint coin. Rulers usually tried to fix coin exchange rates, especially when new coins were issued, for instance, by an increase or decrease of the amount of precious metal each coin should contain. But just what foreign, what native coins were, differed considerably from today, and people wouldn't have understood or defined coin and monetary matters the way we do nowadays, distinguishing between territorial or state monies. There were a number, like hundreds of different coins occasionally circulating alongside each other. And it proved immensely difficult to regulate stable relationships between these several types of coins circulating within often overlapping regional or local currency systems. Relations between bigger coins such as florins and thalers and lower nominal types such as groschen, pennies or hellers were flexible and variable according to type, age and provenience of each coin based on the prevailing gold-silver ratio and the nature of wear and tear of these coins. Whenever these were altered and it became profitable for cunning traders to export undervalued or import overvalued coin, the market would rebalance coin valuations or exchange rates towards their equilibrium price marked by the gold-silver ratio. But what could never be certain about was the precise getting or fixing precise and discrete relation of one coin to the other. During the early modern period, all coins were expected to include at least some precious metal. This was in line with a general understanding of what money was and what it should look like and what it was supposed to do. Theoretically, money was meant to circulate by tail, meaning so many coins to the groschen or so many groschen to the thaler, as fixed by edict, but in practice it often did not, meaning that coins' purchasing power would be derived from the purchasing power of the silver or precious metal they embodied, less often gold minus its production costs. And say, Niraj, in reality, this meant that people ignorant of the finesses of the contemporary monetary standard and monetary market could potentially be tricked or forced into accepting dubious coins at face value. This gave rise to heckling and conflict, potentially numerous coin crimes, counterfeiting, and other usurious manipulations, as we've seen, and manipulations which the political economy literature picked up and continued to pick up right until the end of the empire. Because you find similar complaints as late as the 18th century about the small change. By that time, they didn't cause political revolts anymore. Moreover, minting coins was essentially a free market business, meaning rulers had no effective control of the actual money supply, the main reason being that there were no fixed currency borders or strict delineations of monetary circulation. Potentially, rulers could try and control the basic parameters of monetary policy, how many new coins should be struck from the silver mark, how many of these should be pennies, how many should be medium change coins such as groschen, how many larger nominals, such as thalers. This, however, was counteracted by the nature of how mints were usually run. These were profit-making businesses, and mint masters were profit-making and profit-oriented entrepreneurs. they would transform into current money according to the mint price or mint equivalent set by the ruler. The mint price, on the other hand, determined how much money the mint would pay for purchasing the precious metal, and the difference between the two determined the profitability of the minting business. Since per capita silver supplies faced a protracted decline in the long run between the mid-14th to the 19th century, with population and total economic activity in the German-speaking lands outstripping monetary growth, this created persistent deflationary pressure and a tendency for coins to become lighter and lighter. In short, we've got a whole branch of political economy here, which is contingent upon the business enterprise interests, business interests of mint masters as profit-making businesses, counteracting to an extent the interests of the princely states, who are partially also using the currency and the coinage as a way to raise state revenue, saying Roche, but also need to keep an eye on the currency, because potentially, as it was realized, a bad currency would erode social stability and potentially lead to revolt. Whatever the specific reason for some type of coin and currency turning out to be bad, debased, or evil, in the 1520s, hundreds, if not thousands of different coins circulated, and many of those would have matched that qualifier. Small change debasement was the norm. High-value coins exhibited significantly lower rates of debasement over time. The scholastics and medieval authors, medieval jurists, had habitually stressed that monetary stability was one of the prime policy goals for rulers directed at stabilizing, if not promoting, the common weal. Prices for essentials such as bread, foodstuffs, were usually fixed, often sticky, as were other regular income streams such as rents and dues, often by contract, often fixed for long-term periods. Even though coin debasement chiefly affected urban property owners, in particular the rentier classes, peasants, as we've seen, likewise showed a preference for good money, for reliable money, because in the marketplace and the fiscal realm, they faced various disadvantages when having to pay tax with mostly unreliable, unstable, or even unverifiable evil coin, as the document called them. Coin debasement thus harmed economic interests across the full spectrum of medieval and early modern Stände society. The nobility rulers and their administrators devised ways and means of protecting themselves against deflation and devaluation of rent and tax income, and it's exactly these manipulations that caused much anger and popular unrest. To conclude, many of the late medieval peasants and many urban uprisings and revolts, including and somewhat culminating in the revolution of 1525, which is a term coined by Peter Blickler, were caused, or at least to some degree co-determined, by monetary matters. This is not to say that currency or currency problems generally were a prime or even major reason for social unrest. In some cases, they probably were, as some of the regional grievances clearly put coin issues on top of the agenda as point number two or item number three on the complaints. But taken together and seen in a wider perspective, currency belongs to a bigger matrix of material and social, political, and economic hardship faced especially by the better off peasants and farmers in regions that had witnessed rapidly increasing market integration, commercialization, and specialization post 1850. This is the Annaberg altar piece from the Church of St. Anne in Annaberg in the Saxon Erz Mountains, which was produced in 1523. And this is one of the most beautiful depictions I know of the contemporary silver mining industry in the Erz Mountains. And at a glance, you could see what sort of economy is happening there in the mining. And these were highly specialized, high-powered economies and societies that were intrinsically dependent on the use of cash, and particularly reliable cash. Levels of monetization increased in the period of transformation between the late medieval integration crisis and the age of commercial capitalism, marked by the onset of the last medieval silver mining boom post 1470, which ended one of the greatest medieval bullion famines or deflations of the time. This commercial revolution coincided with the Reformation and became surpassed by the post 1530 secular inflation known to monetary historians as price revolution. When peasants complained about evil coin, böse Münz, they thus addressed political economy issues of a wider nature, far wide-ranging nature, ranging far beyond either the peasant economy or the regional market system. questions relating to international payment, increasingly proto-global payment and trade, merchants' profits, and the common weal, religious salvation and commercial capitalism, even questions of monetary and state capacity and state formation. And I'll stop here and say thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.